So you got tapes on sale for all hours up here. I think you're going to get five for a dollar tonight. My name's Billy Mattingly, and I am an alcoholic. Amen. I'm very grateful to be here tonight sober. And I don't know much about these birdhouses that y'all, but I think God must have had a sense of humor tonight because he gave y'all the bird. So, I want to thank Milton for calling and asking to speak down here, and I want to thank the board for inviting Marietta and I down here to Mont Eagle again. And it's always been a good, we've been here two or three times, and it's always been a good place for us. And I don't know, it's just something about being here. And, you know, I think about the speakers that have stood here prior to me, about the amount of sobriety that we have found in Alcoholics Anonymous, the love that these people have had, all the dedication and service that 37 years of speakers have come before me to this program and come to this roundup. So it's really got to be special. And you know, when you come up on the mountain, you look around and see the people and you see the love of the people with you, and especially all of our friends, and we know who they are. And you know, just maybe, that we are just a little bit closer to God here on the mountain. And it makes you really feel good. But I do want to thank each one of you for being here tonight. I don't know if I could ever be classified a speaker or not. Most people think I'm a BSer. So, I don't know anything to do other than start from the very start of my story. I don't have any really exciting thing to talk about. Matter of fact, you know, each time I get asked to talk at one of these things, it makes me feel a whole lot like Elizabeth Taylor's eighth husband. You know, I know what's expected of me, but I don't know if I'll be able to perform. So it always makes me have a little bit of edge on what I'm going to do. But I am the youngest. Well, I'll tell you, my home group is the Bardstown Thursday Night Group in Bardstown, Kentucky, and that's about 40 miles down the pike from Louisville. We meet on that Thursday night there, and if any of you ever in town, we'd be glad to have any of you. My sobriety date is June the 10th of 1982, and I have a sponsor by the name of Kenny Brown, and thank God for all. And I also have another sponsor whose name is David Murphy. Both of them got me into the program, and when I asked to be my sponsor, they both looked me in the eye and told me to never go to one or to the other and try to manipulate either one of them. They told me, if you want to ask me questions, you ask me, but don't go whining to the other if you don't get the right answer. So these guys set me straight real quick, you know. But I'm the youngest of three boys. I have an older brother that lives in Seattle, Washington, and we're close as distance will allow us to be. I have a brother that was next to me that died as a direct result of alcoholism. And if I don't forget, I'd like to tell you about that a little bit later. But my mom is still living. We just recently bought a new home that was right next door to her. And I think that maybe this is God's way of allowing me to pay back to that lady so many things that she did for me, that I can go over and help see what her needs are today and look in on her. And I'm her baby boy, and you know, and I love it. She spoils me, and I just love it every minute of it. I tell her I don't care how many grandbabies she gets up on that hill. By golly, I'm always going to be the baby boy up there, and I don't want her to forget it, you know. My dad died 2 years ago in December. And, you know, that's another one of those gifts that we get from Alcoholics Anonymous, from Mike and Doug and my sponsor and two or three more guys was in the van. We went down to Asheville, North Carolina to the regional forum. When I got there, I had an emergency phone call. Marietta had called and told me that my father was in real bad shape and should come back home. And Kenny and I, he wouldn't allow me to come back by myself. These guys over here in the corner there, they'd never had any second thoughts about it. They just took me back over to the airport. And you know, it was a strange thing about walking to the airport that day, that we walked in there, and down in Asheville, it looked like to me, this way I remember it, there was just a very large line of ticket booths there at that counter, and that whole entire place was empty, excepting for one person at the ticket booth in one airline. And you know where that airplane was going? It was going back to Louisville. And God got me back in there. And I got home, and my brother got home the next day, and I was able to be with my father, and my brother was able to be with my father when he died. And you know, that's one of the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous, that when I was drinking, that I wouldn't give you 10 cents to even think about stuff like that. But when you find someone that you've got love for, and you're able to be there and to serve them or to help them as much as you can, and love someone as much as I love my father, you've got to know that the power of Alcoholics Anonymous is working for you, you know. But we lived out on an old farm that had us three boys, mom and dad, and we didn't have much up and down the road. Everybody just about the same as everybody else. We didn't have anything to compare to. Ever who had the most patches on their pants was the ones with the poorest, or ever how you want to put it. We all had a great deal of love out on the farm there, and didn't know much about the money. We didn't know we was poor until the government come along, took a survey, told us we were, you know. One thing that we did is it was always that great deal of love in our family, you know, and that's still there today. Mom and Dad gave us boys as much as they possibly could. And I never really had any problem with alcoholism in our family. We had drinkers in our family. We never had no alcoholics. We didn't want none of them in the family there, you know. And we had some drinkers. My grandpa, now I guess he was the heaviest drinker we had. And booze finally got him at 93. So, you know, that's how much we had. But we lived on a farm, and nothing exciting was happening in our life. And I went to school, had a normal childhood, I guess, in school. My dad, every time I was in high school where I started having problems, and it was not because of anything anybody else did, just I didn't like to go to school. And I just didn't like to sit in there. I'd look out those windows, and the sun was be shining, and that's where I want to be, out there where the sun was shining. And that Marietta gets on me sometimes a day when the sun shines. I'm outside, and she wants me inside doing something. I want to be out there with sunshine. But while I was in high school, met my pretty lady there I got with us tonight. And first night I met her, we was down at her grandmother's house, like she said, and she was in there, and she had that little ponytail. And she'd run through that house, you know, And you know, I thought she was just the cutest little old thing that I ever seen in my life. I'd run after her, and that ponytail would bounce up and down, and I'd catch her, and I'd raise that thing up and ask her if it was a he or a she, you know. And she'd giggle, and I'd giggle, and we thought that was just so cute. And I'm telling you, I sat back there in that chair yesterday, and I looked at her, and she looked so beautiful standing up here to me. And you know, I just saw her yesterday, and I still think she's just about the cutest damn thing I've ever seen in my life. Excuse my friend. But now, it ain't always been that way, you know. There were some times that she wasn't too cute, you know. But, you know, I met her, and I don't know what it was about her daddy. I don't know. She told you how strict her daddy was, and he was a little older in age, you know. And you know, I don't know where he didn't like me or he didn't trust her. I'm not really sure what the deal was on that. But he wouldn't let us go out on regular dates. Now, he thought that you'd do or do the courting out on the front porch. And we had a problem. He didn't have no porch. He didn't have no front one. He didn't have no back one. But he did have a great big old silver leaf poplar tree out there. And that's where we always parked the car. And, you know, when I got to going up there seeing her the second time, she, I don't know, 15, 16, 17, ever what we were. I mean, you know what? And he let us go outside when the sun started going down a little bit, you know. And we go out there and sit in the car underneath that big old silver leaf poplar tree out there. And we get in that car, and she snuggled over real close to me and lay her head up on my shoulder, you know, and I looked down at them grave gold pretty eyes, and you know, my hands would go in search of serenity right then and there. Gosh, no. I don't know what she had going on with the program, but she'd look up at me and she'd tell me such things as, you know, if you want I have what I have, you should be willing to go to any length to get it. You know, half measures availed me nothing. And I wanted it, and we got married. And you know, and 38 years later, I was asking last night, just wondering what the heck the big deal was, you know. I guess time has a way of taking care of everything, but that I know today that I know today that God put this lady in my life, because no one else could have ever done with me or for me what she has done. And you know, it's just a beautiful thing that she stayed with me all these. And honey, thank you, and I love you. But we got married, and I was in the Navy, and I was stationed down in Cuba, and she couldn't be with me and all these kind of things. And I'd already been down in Norfolk for a while, but I got transferred to New Jersey. First time we were going to be able to live together as husband and wife, and we were going to have our very first argument and our child and be living together all in just a very short span of time. And the argument come not from drinking, had nothing to do with drinking. Had everything in the world to do with my ego. Now my ego was just a little bit small for my ego. You know, I got to keep it in check pretty much. But we had our very first little daughter, and she was such a beautiful thing to us, you know, our very first child. And I was in, when we had these little shotgun houses. Anyway, she had just run over across the lawn. Heck, they wasn't over close from here to Bob there. And just run over there, and our little girl was laying on the bed, and I came in for lunch, something I never did. And when I come in, the little girl was crying, and you know, when she come back, that I got all over, and you know, how dare you leave my child laying there crying like that? And I don't know how I thought things happened, but anyway, I never gave this lady any credit for that little girl being there. And you know, and that's the way I started things, and I don't know where I learned this or heard this or anything else, but it seemed like to me that a wife was a wife, and she was supposed to walk one half step behind like the old Indians were supposed to do. Now, that don't work good either at our house, you know. But this is the thinking I had at the time. But anyway, and this argument we got into, I never thought too much about it until after I heard her start talking in Alcoholics Anonymous or in Al-Anon, and I could hear some of the hurt and the pain that she had because of that, and I never understood that at the time. But we got out of the Navy, and I had several jobs there in Bardstown. One of them was delivering milk like she was telling you about, and gave me ample opportunity to drink. Those folks didn't care if you drank as long as you got the milk on the step when it was supposed to be there. And had another job at a service station. He didn't care as long as you got the gas in the tank. I finally went to work at Ford Motor Company, where I just recently retired from after 32 years. And through the grace of God and some good folks that worked at Ford Motor Company is the reason I was able to retire. I started working down there at Ford, and it was in the middle of June, and it was hot. And I didn't know anything about the job. You have to work especially hard, you know, when you don't know what you're doing. I'd watch these guys at dinner time. That bell would ring. And just about the time that bell was ringing, they just seemed like they was gone. And I would sit there, and I'd sweat and eat my sandwich. About a half hour here, they'd come back. And they must have read the big book when they went there, because when they come back, they was all happy, joyous, and free, you know. And I asked them, I said, how'd y'all do this? I said, I ate my sandwich, and I don't feel that way. No, we didn't eat no sandwich. Now, we went over to Skyway Liquor Store. And, baby, I'm telling you what, I found me a home. They said, you want to watch what we do, you know, you can go do that. And I learned that I could leave the place where I worked, and I'd run out across that bottle shop, across Chassis Line, get out in the parking lot, squall tires across the street, you know, Skyway Liquor Store in 6 minutes. And I loved that place. I had 18 minutes to drink, 6 minutes back, and I was still tired when I got back. And I had to ask them, I said, y'all, I ain't doing what y'all doing. Now, what's the problem? I said, well, we don't drink beer like you do. We drink whiskey. Now, a whole lot of people would stand up here and tell you all about the scientific nature of how you progress from whiskey, I mean, to beer from whiskey. But now, I just wanted, that was scientific right there for me, because I just started drinking because I wanted to get more of it and faster. That's as scientific as I can be. But anyway, I started to get over. I started drinking me a half pint at lunch, and I found out that I could take me a half pint on my leg, and I'd go back to work about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That first half pint wore off, and I could reach down there and get that off my leg. You know, and I reached down and started taking that tape off my leg. I pulled every hair I had out of my leg. I had the slickest legs at Ford Motor Company. I could probably went to a chorus line and made it, you know. But anyway, I have always had a hard time identifying with an alcoholic about drinking in the morning, because everything we did was in the morning. When you start working at 4:30 in the morning and lunch is in the morning and you're getting it off at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, this the drinking in the morning for the alcoholic, it didn't ring no bells for me, because everything, our whole day was in the morning. But we did that for a long time. Over a period of time, I started stopping over at the Skyway after work, you know. And I would get me a couple more beers, maybe another drink or two, and I would try to make it home best I could. And Marietta never could understand how I could get home drunk. And I never would tell her how much I was drinking, you know. It's just the old typical thing about, you know, how much did you drink? And you go, I just drank a couple of beers, you know, and went home. And she never could understand that. But she found out later on about that. It's sort of like that judge, you know, when you get to telling too many lies, you're going to hear something along the way. But well, these three drunks went up to see the judge, and all of them's there for drunken driving. And the first one went up there, and the judge asked him, how much you been drinking? I had 2 beers, judge. And the judge got angry right away. He said, I'm going to make an example out of these people who have been telling me this kind of thing. And he said he charged that guy $500 and 10 days in jail. Second one come up, and how many beers did you drink? I only had 2, judge. And he said, $500 and 10 days in jail. Third one come up, and he said, how much do you have to drink? And I don't know, judge. It might have been 1 or 3, but it sure wasn't 2. So that's the way I got started. It sure wasn't 2 anymore. It's always something different. And I found myself after a time sitting over at Skyway later on at night, and you know, and this is, like I say, this is over a period of years. And I found myself sitting there in the afternoon, and if you've ever start getting that hurt that's on the inside, the hurt that you don't tell people about because they'll laugh at you, and they'll call you panty waste and all these kind of things. And I would sit there on that bar, and you know, that hurt would be on the inside, and you'd want to go home. And I can remember Marietta being, or I think about Marietta being at home having supper with the children, you know, and it really doesn't sound like much, just the want to get up off a bar stool and go home and have supper. And there's nothing wrong with anybody that I know of that can go into a bar and have a cup of beers, unless you happen to be like me. If you were to go into that bar, sit down, have a cup of beers, I did not know when to go home. I love the atmosphere of that bar, and I can tell you just exactly what that bar looks like tonight. And I love that bar. You know, I get in there, and I hear the cue balls are clicking, Benny, and the women be laughing, and that jukebox will be a-going, and they had a great big old Budweiser wagon setting up against that mirror, and it would reflect that, and they had twice as much whiskey there as it looked like they really was, you know. And I don't know why, every time I tell that, I get thirsty. But, you know, I would sit there, and I would just hurt, and I couldn't tell the bartender. I mean, how are you supposed to tell your bartender that Billy Joe, I'm hurting on the inside. I don't want another drink. All I want to do is go home. You can't tell that guy that because he's going to cut you off. You can't sit there and tell your guy on your right or your left that you're hurting on the inside because he's going to laugh at you and he's going to call you some kind of panty waste and you're going to be out there fighting somewhere. So you just sit there and you just stuff that stuff. But you know, we alcoholics are lucky people in a way because if we had some way of drowning the hurt and the pain, we could always take another drink and we could drain that, drown that pain just for a little while. And you know, I've listened to Marietta speak many times, and we're lucky because our loved ones have no place to hide all that hurt. They stay, they watch their husbands or wives or alcoholics in their family go down the tubes, and there's nothing that they can do about it except worry and hurt on the inside with all the terror that you find in the home, the children that are ruined for life sometimes from alcoholism, the actions of a crazy mother and a drunk father. That's what we started having in our home. Many times I'd want to go home and I would make it home. And when I got home, you know, the only thing I would want to do most of the time was go out and get me another drink. And just as soon as I would get there, I would get into an argument with Marietta and just give me that excuse to leave and go back out and drink some more. I don't want to stand here and tell you tonight that there was no fun in our life whatsoever, because there was. And most of you heard her talk this morning and you heard about many of the things we did. We had many parties and went to many parties and we had lots of laughter in our home. And the things we had some beautiful friends, and through the disease of alcoholism, I just drank them all up. And that's what happened to us. And we came down to the point where I was coming home and starting that argument and going back out and drinking more. We had many, many fights during this time, you know, and the abuse started out verbally. Then, of course, all the mental abuse that we give our loved ones that we don't really understand when we're drinking. And then it got to be into the physical abuse. And, you know, and I was one of them guys from the old school at the time that said, I don't care whatever happens, I'll never hit a woman, you know. You get the macho type guy, the cavalier type that you know is you're going to be this sweet, innocent guy in her life and you'll be there. Light and shining armor. Well, I had rusty armor and I never got to do any of that kind of thing because I was one that was beating on my family through the disease of alcoholism. I worked down there at Ford and these guys down there at Ford, they decided they didn't like the way I was drinking. They fired me twice from that job. And each time this guy would fire me, and Rodney was in the labor relations department, and I had to go see labor relations each time that I got caught drinking. He took me up there twice and fired me twice. But each time that he gave me a chance to go to a treatment center and get dried out and come back to work. And Rodney always, he told me many times, you know, he really liked the work that I did and all this kind of stuff, but he couldn't tolerate what I did when I was drinking. And, you know, a whole lot of times we think that there aren't anyone outside of these rooms who know and understand alcoholism, but if there was a guy in my life, Rodney knew and he understood alcoholism, and he knew that long before I did. And he tried everything in the world he could do to help me, like you folks did when I first got here, and I turned my back on him. I started doing the things I wasn't supposed to do. I started staying out all night. Two nights, three nights, or what it was. I would be over at Skyway or another bar with a different name, but same faces and same things inside of them. And I would start drinking in the afternoon when I got off from work or during the day or whatever it was I was doing. And I would drink until I pass out, and I would either park my truck back or in somebody's parking lot. Park it over in front of work a lot of times because these guys knew that when they got there, if my truck was there, they always walked by and checked the truck to see if I was in there asleep or passed out. And many times they find me in the back of the truck or sometimes up in the cab. Some of them would stop by Skyway every now and then and check on to see if I was over there. And, you know, when I first got married, my mom and dad were married for many, many years, and I never seen my mom and dad to actually get into physical fights, but I'd seen a lot of bean bowls fly every now and then. You know, they had to show their anger in their way. But, you know, when I first got married, the only thing that I wanted to do was be a good husband and a good father and be a good son. And over a period of a few short years, I became a failure on all points. And, you know, that's another thing about being in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, being amongst the people that you love and the people that love you, is that when I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started doing the things that was asking this program and started working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I started getting better. And somewhere, I don't know how far along the line it was, that I could look down and say that Billy's not a failure anymore. And you know, if there's anyone that had failed at everything that they tried, it was me. And, you know, and I didn't want to be that way. I started, you know, the children came along and we had these three beautiful children, got two girls and a boy, and when they were real small. I think about these things sometimes, and it still really hurts to think about what alcoholism can do to a family. That you have a father who's a drunk and a mother who's about half nuts because of the drunk, and you have these three beautiful children that's going to watch all of it. And they had a front seat to everything. We didn't try to hide anything. I never questioned the will of God anymore, but you know, sometimes you just wonder what is the wisdom of giving a blooming alcoholic and a crazy woman three children to raise. But you know, I can look today and I can understand that God in His wisdom, and surely not ours, gives us the people that we need at the time that we need them. But I can remember one time in particular, and I never try to give a talk without reminding myself of this, because this to me was the breakup of everything that I held dear in that family, every principle that we had in that family. I had been off somewhere on one of these drunks, and I don't know how many times I had done this before. Many, I don't know how many, but I had come home that day, and Marietta started summer chin music, you know, that all of us get, and I was doing the same thing, and we got to fighting. I don't know, our three little children were standing there, and you know, I don't know where I hit her or where I pushed her, or I really don't know what happened. But I know that she fell up against the door facing, and when she did, she made a great big huge place on her head. And she fell down on the floor and she was crying. And these three children of ours, and they were just real small. You could hear them back there screaming, crying. And when I look back there, I can remember it just like I've remembered anything in my whole life. To see all the hurt, terror, confusion, anger, just not knowing why Daddy is doing Mama like this, you know. And these little children just squalling up a storm too. And you know, really what I wanted to do, all I really wanted to do was just to reach down and pick Marietta up, hold her in my arms, and tell her that I was sorry, that I didn't want to be that way. But once I asked her, was she okay? And she said she was. The only thing that I could do was to kick at her and say, if you're okay, get up. And I walked out of the house. If there's ever anything that I didn't want was something like that. I wanted to be someone like my father, who was so good to my mom. My mom was good to my dad. Her family was good to one another. And I wanted to be that way. But if you want another drink of alcohol enough, if you want to get away enough, love will not ever stop you from taking that drink. And you know, and I tried many, many times to stop taking that drink. We continued with a whole lot of this kind of nonsense. It got them into just a terrible place to live at. It was our home. If you wanted to come into a circus or a zoo or something like you're going into those prize fights or Saturday night fights, you just visit our house and it could be going on at any time. These children were growing up and they would, like Meretta told you, they would meet their mama in the driveway and tell her mama, don't go home, daddy's drunk, they might find me out. The children could not by any chance invite anyone to our home. They just didn't have friends to bring home because they didn't know what I was going to be doing. And these children tell their mama, daddy's drunk, we'll be gone somewhere. And they did. They just scattered out over the top of the neighborhood somewhere. And sometimes they would be there and sometimes I wouldn't. Come Christmas time, you never know what to expect. You know, one Christmas I can remember that we was all going to go to Christmas Mass. And this is Mary a nice thing today. We make sure we make Christmas Mass at midnight. And that's our thing. Church don't cooperate anymore. They have it at 10 o'clock. But, you know, I can remember this one time, and our oldest girl had a boyfriend at the time, and we was going to go to Mass down here at the little chapel right down beside where we lived at, where my mother worked, called Nazareth Mother House. And they've got a beautiful chapel down there that the Catholic nuns go to. And I can remember, I thought, you know, this is going to be the time that I was going to go out and I was going to be the man for a night, because I went over and I got a bunch of wine and all the children were going to have a little taste of wine before we went to Mass, and we was going to come back home, we was going to have a dinner and get some more wine. Well, I drank whiskey before I got the wine. I drank the wine and I passed out before I got to church. And they laid me out on the bed and I don't know what I did. I just passed out, I guess. And I guess they went ahead and done their thing. But I made a shambles of it. Every time that I was to start doing things like that, I just made a shambles of our home. It seems like, you know, I've heard it that I didn't get drunk every time I drank. And I didn't get locked up every time I got drunk, or I didn't get in trouble every time I got drunk. But every time I caused or got caught in any trouble, I had been drinking. And that was the way of my life. Everything that I touched, it seemed like that I caused chaos in some way. My mom and dad got to where they hated to see me come by. Daddy, he would take off in the car and go to the store, or he'd go out there and start doing something outside. And poor mom, she couldn't get outside too much. She couldn't drive, still can't drive today. And she's the only one that would have to sit there and listen to all my garbage. But every now and then, you know, she'd fix her a drink too. I guess she didn't want to hear it no more. You know, she'd take a little nip with me, you know. But, all the time this is going on, we see ourselves going out into bars. And sometimes we see other people going out. And you see that these people are really somebody. They're big guys. They're living their life. They're doing what they want to do. But, you know, if we had a mirror to look on the inside and see that hurt and all that pain that was going on inside, to take down the mask on the head and look at all the total confusion that was on the inside of there, you could see me or us. That's what we see when we see all these guys going out there with a hand raised high and said, I'm doing what I want to. Total confusion and chaos. Marietta and I ended up getting separation, and I know she got this on this separation because of medical reasons. She was just plumb sick of me. And that's this thing lasted for 4 months. And I was best I can remember how this happened was that the sheriff come out there and I was home. He got me and he's giving me these papers and he told me I had to leave. And I had an old dirty sheet there or a sheet somewhere off bed or whatever. And I throwed some clothes in the back of that truck and hooked up my boat and I was off to glory land. Man, I'm telling you, I was freed up, get to go do anything I wanted to do. I was free and I didn't have to answer to no one. And my mom and dad lived about a quarter mile down the road. And the time I got there, I was crying all over myself because I knew I'd lost everything that I loved dear in my life. And if I was to go to my mom and dad's house right now and go up the upstairs where I was raised at and look out that upstairs window, I can still see the top of the house that we were living in then. And I was that close to my family and yet so far, far away. Just couldn't possibly reach them. And you know, I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that I loved my wife and children just as much as I could possibly love them. I just could not show it when I was drinking. Just didn't know how. You know, I'm going to tell this part of this story, and I don't do it in a very light way because it still hurts when I think about it, but it may help someone else. You know, I know that Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon is not supposed to save marriages. And I know this. Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon will help people. We can put people back together so they know how to do what they need to do. But at this time, we didn't have AA and Al-Anon, and I didn't know what to do about it. I had been seeing this lady. You know, everybody needs somebody to understand. I found one over at the Skyway Liquor Store. And she understood. I fell in love. And off we went. And when Marietta kicked me out, I knew this is the love of my life, that I would always be there, that I would never do anything to harm anyone. 2 weeks later, I was into doing the same thing that I was doing to my own family. I was doing to her family the same way I was doing mine. And that's all in alcoholism, because I just didn't know any different. It was later that I found myself going back up those upstairs, that old house. And I went back to the bedroom that I was raised in, spent my childhood in, laid down on that bed and cried like a baby because I didn't know what to do, didn't know where to go, didn't know what was happening. And you know what? I don't know how many guys have cried because they were so confused and hurt, pain coming out. But this is one guy that would cry. But I wouldn't let you see me do it. You know, all the ego and all the false pride that you put up front, I would tell those guys down at Ford, boy, I got rid of that old bag. I don't have to be bothered with her no more. I don't have to worry about taking them kids to anywhere. They ain't going to take up my time no more. Have to go to these ball games and all these kind of things. And then on the inside, I was begging God to let me do that, you know. Just let me get back home so I can go do those things. But I would tell those other people, I don't have to do nothing. I tell my mom and daddy the same thing. I don't have to do nothing. And you know, if there's two people that knew that they had raised a liar, they knew that they had one in their home. They knew that they had a liar sitting there with them. This thing lasted for about 4 months, and Marietta told you at Christmas time how it was, and I was so happy to get back home, and I promised her the world and gave her hell. That's the only way I know how to put it, because 2 weeks after we were back together, or 3 weeks back, I was doing the exact same things as I was doing before. I don't know how many promises I've ever made to her while I was drinking that I kept, if any. I don't know if I've never kept any of those things. But anyway, we did all these kind of things, and we did get in this new home that she was telling you about, and I really did think, you know, we can come up with some real sick thinking sometimes, but I really did think that if we could move out of this old house we was living in, move into a brand new house, it would be a brand new life. I didn't understand that every time that we went somewhere, we took us with us. And I didn't know that. I didn't understand it. I thought, well, you change locations, you change life. But we didn't change anything except in place where we laid down at night. And sometimes I wasn't there. And I can remember so many times that staying out in that old truck, just laying out at night somewhere and not come home, and maybe just drive off the side of the road and lay out in the fence line somewhere, just because I just could not bear to go back home and face what was there at home. And that was a whole lot with the guilt and the pain and all the stuff that I knew that I was wrong. I don't know how many alcoholics in here tonight believe this, but I believe that we alcoholics know the difference between right and wrong when I drink and when I don't drink, even though I knew I was wrong, but I didn't know what to do about it. And I'd lay out on them old fence lines or in that truck or just anywhere I could find a sleep, you know, I wouldn't come home. We finally got back together, and we'd done all these kind of things, and I did all those kind of things, and I found myself on June 10th, 1982, sitting on some steps down at Pleasant Grove Hospital in Louisville. Again, I was just crying like a baby because I didn't know what to do. Had no idea about where to do. 3 years prior to this, and Bob and I was talking about this last night. 3 years prior to this, I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous by way of the court system. They had seen me there enough. And you know, I believe this is probably the first time that I had ever heard the term alcoholic, and that was applied to me, was district judge there said that I was an alcoholic, but he don't know it. And I know that's one of those words that he used. I don't think I could have thought that in any other way. And they was going to put me in long-term treatment, or they was going to put me in jail, and the county attorney wanted to send me off to the prison system to let me, you know, do that up there. But they gave me a choice of going 6 months in jail, 30 days at a treatment center. I didn't know what kind of treatment they was going to give me, but I know it was better than 6 months in jail. I knew that because I've been there. And, you know, I don't have nothing against treatment centers today. Heck, I went 13 times. Now, I ain't got nothing against them. I went off down to that treatment center, and that's where I met a guy named Mel, and Mel started taking me to AA meetings. And that's my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. But it took me 3 years coming around, going to your meetings, reading your book, listening to what you had to say, even talked at your meetings under the influence of alcohol. This is not the plan it has in the big book. This ain't the way it's supposed to work. But this is the way it worked for me. I don't recommend it for anybody else. But I would go to these meetings, and you know, this is why I love my home group so much, and this is why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. These folks would never, ever tell me to leave. I have never been invited to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to my home group, and I would sit there, and sometimes I would disturb the meeting, and those guys would pick me up and take me back into the restroom, or they would take me out the door, and they would sit there and talk with me. And after the meeting, they'd tell me to come back, you know. And you know, Marietta and I have been so long since anybody had ever asked us to come back anywhere. They just didn't want us back nowhere. And these guys would take care of me, and they would see that I had a way to the meeting. And every time that I ever called on any one of them, they would come. When I went to treatment centers and I was in jail, you know, I would tell all these people about my drinking friends that I had. I got to get out of here and go see my friends, you know, down at such and such bar, or I would have to go somewhere else to see such and such friend. And I would invite the whole group of you, if you're ever in a treatment center again, just call some of them drinking buddies and see how many of them ever come and see you. Because none of them ever come see me, especially when I was in jail. But you know what? I could call any one of these people that I had met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would make sure that they either came to my house and picked me up or made sure that I had some way to go into a meeting. And these guys, it was just David was one, and Art and Joe and my sponsor Kenny, and all these guys would come along and they'd pick me up. And I went to meetings and I didn't understand. I just didn't understand how. I loved the meetings and I loved what I saw. These guys, their wives were coming over and they were holding their hands and they would love on them. I would listen to the guys at the podium and they would tell me how happy they were. And I really, honest to God, wanted that. I wanted it so bad. I wanted it for my home. I wanted it for my wife, my children. And I tried. I tried every way I knew how to do that. You know, you would tell me, put the plug in the jug and don't drink. If I had known how to do that, I wouldn't have needed you. What I needed was someone that would take me by the hand and finally lead me through everything that I was to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found it in that group in Bardstown. I did these things for 3 years, and after 3 years of going to meetings drunk, drinking, whatever, I found myself sitting on the most steps down there on June 10th, 1982, crying like a baby, but still didn't know what to do. If there's anything in my life that I believe today, I believe this with all my heart. I believe that God really does love drunks and fools, because I believe I set her on that steps that day, and I believe if there's anything that ever happened was that the hand of God was on my shoulder, and he says, I'm going to give you that one more chance. Don't blow it. As of today, I've not had another drink, one day at a time. And for that, I have to thank the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, loving God, and people just like you that I've met all over the world. Marietta and I got into this thing after I got out of that treatment center, and she finally come and got and get me that day she was telling you about. After, I think I was down there 3 or 4 days, and she didn't tell you exactly what happened. She just, whenever I called her up, I've been gone for about 3 days and all drunked up and messed up like we are when we've been drunked up for 3 days. And I told her that her lover boy is ready to come home, you know. And she told me that tough S word, you know, you got there, you get home best way you know how. But she finally did to come over and pick me up on Sunday afternoon, I believe is what it was. But let me tell you something, guys, and this is for anybody, any alcoholic. If you think you might want to do a little more drinking after you've been to a treatment center, don't let your wife get in Al-Anon or your husband. It'll just screw it up more than Alcoholics Anonymous will. I'm telling you, them dudes know what they're doing too. Marietta, she would tell me all these kind of things like that, you know. Oh, you know, it'll be all right. I'm going to go do this, and you just do what you have to do. Oh, and it just tore me up, just irritated me to death. But anyway, she come down and picked me up that day, and she had been at an Al-Anon meeting with some, I was thinking it was with some Al-Ateens. I ain't sure what she was doing. But anyway, on the way home, I told her that I felt something different, that there was something inside that felt like that it was just, everything was going to be okay. And I haven't drank since then, but everything has been okay, you know. I've been okay, but things haven't been okay. I started this journey into Alcoholics Anonymous, and with the help of Kenny, helped me take these sponsors. We had a great big loop out there at Bardstown where we would take meetings to, various meetings around the place, and the closest meeting we had to Bardstown at that time was 19 miles away, and that's over at that Springfield group that's going to buy all these tapes tonight. And we went over to those meetings, and we went in some groups for about 65 miles down the road, but we always found time to go and had money enough to put money in the gas tank. I didn't have no money because I done spent mine on booze and judges and doctors and lawyers, and Marietta and I was just living from day to day. I mean, it wasn't even paycheck to paycheck. It was from day to day. But they started coming, picking me up, and we started going to these meetings. And I rode with Kenny the biggest part time. And we was start talking about the meetings and what Alcoholics Anonymous meant. And that's what it took for me. Kenny had to take me from day one and tell me everything there was about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would be drunk, he'd pick me up. I'd be sober, he'd pick me up. David, big drunk, sober, whatever, he'd pick me up. Joe, Art, all those guys. And they would allow me to do that and still come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my home group would let me be there. Well, Kenny started coming over and checking me on me on a Friday night. And if I was doing okay on a Friday night, well, on the weekends of the area assemblies, he would take and let me go to area assemblies with him. And I found something I fell in love with. They fought. They would just get up there and have just awfulest arguments you ever heard about AA and Al-Anon. I mean, AA and alcohol, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was naive enough at that time when I went to my very first area committee meeting. I thought we was going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, so I took my big book. I never did that again. I always leave it in the room. I take my service manual now, and that's almost like a big book, but I took my big book, and that's how much I knew about service and Alcoholics Anonymous. But I started into this thing, and I got elected to the drunk GSR. I got elected to the GSR, and I would drink. And these guys, they I don't know if they ever asked me to resign or where I was supposed to resign or not. Probably wouldn't have if they'd asked me to. And I was like that, and I finally got elected sober GSR. And I went along for a while as GSR and was elected DCM of District 5, and then I was finally elected delegate to the General Service Conference in New York. But, you know, just to stand, and those of you that have been through it know what I mean, to be able to stand on the floor of the General Service Conference with the other delegates that represent the entire population of the United States and Canada, and just to see the people there and the love of the people that sent you there, the trust that they have in you, the love. They know that you're going to take the responsibility of what you're supposed to do. But if you've ever just stood there and felt that, you know what, all of us guys are supposed to be macho, but here comes the tears again, because I could walk on that floor, and the very first time I was just overwhelmed by everything I saw there. But, you know, many of us, in our haste to help or whatever we do, we want to go out and we collect these titles like I did. And I was fascinated with titles when I first got here. They don't fascinate me much anymore. But I got fascinated with these titles, and I started collecting all these titles, and I thought I was really getting to be somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was getting high in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we can be elected to these things, get all these titles. We can get to be speakers at conferences like I'm doing tonight. We can get to be a guru of the East Coast. We can get to be a guru of the West Coast. Just get just as high in Alcoholics Anonymous as you think you are. But I can stand here tonight, and I'll guarantee each and every one of the people here tonight, the highest that anyone will ever get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. That's as high as we can get. This is God's gift to us. I believe that if there's anything that has happened, that God has already given us the greatest gift that we will ever have. He's given us the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's given us the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, of which we can apply to our daily lives and become living human beings rather than the zombies that we were. He's given us the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, so precious in principle as our steps are, that we can have the unity and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that can allow us to have meetings all over the world and protect and maintain these things so we can have other people to come in. You know, tonight we saw Jim give this book to Melissa. It's a beautiful thing to see people start growing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. To see someone like myself that come in here that was beat down and dead out, just didn't know what was going on, to see them start to grow. And we tell and we say that the newcomers are the most important people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me say that if this is true, then it's got to be equally important that our old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous, if the newcomers are the lifeblood of the fellowship, then the old-timers have got to be the heartbeat that pumps it. We need each and every one of you guys, and please keep coming back to us, because we need you so very much. I started in this thing, and you know what, I could have done all these things, but when I first started getting sober, I got back into the family and was trying to do the things in the family. When we were separated, I thought I had to know who, how, when, where, what, and how many times. Had to know everything that she done. Well, I found out maybe it's not so good that we know who, how, when, where, what, and how many times, you know. And it seems like this man and woman, they've been married 50 years. And on the wedding day, the moral of this whole story is, if you're going to ask a question, you better be expecting or better be willing to accept the answer. So on wedding day, this woman told the man, honey, there's one thing in all of our marriage life I want you to do. I don't want you looking in this great big old box we got over here. And Marietta calls it a hope chest, but I call it a big old box. He didn't think that was a much request, so he said he would do that, not ever look into that thing. So he went on 50 years doing whatever it is they do for 50 years during married life. They come up the 50th wedding anniversary, and the man looks at the woman. He says, "Honey, I think I earned the right to look into that box." That's the only thing he had to do on the wedding day. "I don't want to look in that box. Now I want to look in." And she thought long, and she thought hard. And she said, finally said, "Okay, I think it's time. You can look into that box." So he runs over and flips up top. And he looks in there, and he finds 2 ears of corn and a great big pile of money. He said, "My golly, son." He said, "Why did you put them 2 ears of corn in that box?" And she thought hard again, and she finally told me, she said, "Well, every time I was unfaithful to you, I would put an ear of corn in that box." So he thought about that 2 times 50 years. All the things that he had done out on the streets while he was out there, you know. He looked at her and he said, "Honey, I think that's forgivable. I love you, and I won't ever ask about that again." He said, "Where did you get that great big pile of money at over there?" She said, "Well," she said, "every time I got a bushel of that corn, I'd sell it." Well, you know. Just one of those things, if you're going to ask the question, that you better be willing to accept the answer. And you know, as Mariette and I got into the program of Al-Anon and AA, and she started going to Al-Anon and I was going to my program, and we started growing, I suppose, what the real thing happened. And all the things that she had done and all the things I had done that we thought we had to know, they become small potatoes compared to the things that we were starting to do. When you start to apply these beautiful steps in your life, and when we decided that I was powerless over alcohol and there was nothing I could do about it, that my life was completely unmanageable, and I knew I was crazy, and that I was going to accept that there is somebody that could help me to restore this sanity to me, and when, especially when it come time to turn my will and my life over to the care of a loving God as I could understand Him. After the third step, I'm no longer in the picture. It all belongs to God. I'm His instrument. I do as I ask. The only thing He asks me to do from there on is to clean up my life. After I clean up my life, that I can go out and help others. And that's the 12 steps. And you know, I didn't do them good. I haven't done them real good today. But I do the best that I can today. And where it used to be, if I didn't do it good, I wouldn't do it at all. But today I've learned that this thing is just a day-by-day thing for me, and I do the best. I try to be the best me that I can be today. And that's all I think God wants us to do. And, you know, there's many times that I had turned my back on God, and I hear so many people say that we're supposed to be looking for God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think our big book says that we go through all these things we read and do our steps. And as we go through the steps, it says that we are going to find a power that will solve our problems. And all the steps that we work and the application of these steps in our life is just to find that power that would guide us on our journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Mariette and I started doing these things, and I started doing this, and she doing her things, and all these things we had to know, they just become just such small things. And we started doing, going out and meeting people. I think there's two great things that's happening here tonight. We have a thing we call the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's in the big book, the first 164 pages. And now we have the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's us. And I think it takes both in order for any one person to come in that door tonight and learn to love and to accept and to be happy in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes us and a program. Sometimes I get into believing that I believe that maybe the sponsorship is one of the weakest things we have in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I listened to the guys like was help here on the front row, and I can hear what they said about being in the old time AA. Shut up, get in the car. Come on, you don't know what you're talking about, so just shut up. And you know, so many times I would come out of those treatment centers and I hear that treatment center talk, and they would give me just enough knowledge to be dangerous. And I could have killed somebody from the way I talked when I first come out of those things. But you know, there's a whole lot of times you sign the guys, you know, we always sitting in the meeting. This happens old Barstown from time to time. be sitting there. You know, some old guy will come in the door over there. And you may see two or three guys. They'll get up, go over, and welcome to the meeting, help them over the table, maybe give them a cup of coffee or something else like that. But you see a pretty young thing come in there with her dress up to wear, and you see about 20 guys swarm over there, going to be her sponsor. They got a big book in one hand and a zipper in the other. They're going to sponsor her in something. It might be BB or CC, but it ain't going to be AA by the time they get done, you know. And I think this is what makes it so important for a sponsor, that we're supposed to be going through a spiritual leadership in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're supposed to be leading someone through the spiritual principles of the steps. And then after we go through the spiritual principles of steps, that we try to help going through the principles of unity and of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's my beliefs today. I know there's lots of times that I fall far short of doing some of the things that I've even talked about tonight. But leastwise, I try to be the best me that I can be today. And you know, our children today, I'm so proud of them. We have these two girls that's married to these guys. And if I had put on a resume to get a son-in-law, I would have messed it up. These girls were so sharp in choosing their husbands. It's a good thing I didn't. Good thing I didn't. And these guys are just excellent guys, and they love my daughters. And the only thing I ever asked them was just to love them and take care of them. And we got those four grandchildren, and I think this is God's gift back to me again. He's given me so many, but I believe this is a special one, that God has given me those grandchildren to watch grow, because I missed so much of my own. And you know, I think he gave me the other a gift, and you hear it on radio and TV a whole lot about Hallmark credit card, you know, or Hallmark cards, you know. He cared enough for me to send the very best, you know. And that's what I love, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love you guys. And if ever you see somebody sitting out there in a bar somewhere, looks like he's hungover, looks like he needs so much help, make sure you take a look at him, because it might be me and I'll need your help. If I see somebody, I look, it might be you. And for everything that we can give and serve Alcoholics Anonymous, that I believe in the first tradition, it says that personal recovery depends upon the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous first, us second, service after that. And I believe that is everything that we've got here in this room tonight. This roundup offers love to everyone who's come in here and asked for it. The times that we have been down here, we could have never been served any more gracious than what we have been here. We've been loved when we wasn't lovable, and we've been treated with kindness. And I don't know how much better you can get than that. I don't know if I said anything that would help anybody tonight, but I know that I am glad this talk is over. So if anyone today has not really told you that they love you today, I do. And I love you not because of what you are, but what I am when I'm with you. Thank you. I love you. I may your God bless you.